lot of it had to do, they say, with Ukraine.
But Mr. President,
it's very interesting. It's very interesting. They have the server, right, from the DNC, Democratic National Committee.
Who has the server?
Now, the FBI went in and they told him, get out of here. You're not kidding. We're not giving it to you. They gave the server to CrowdStrike or whatever it's called, which is a country, which is a company owned by a very wealthy Ukrainian. And I still want to see that server. You know, the FBI has never gotten that server. That's a big part of this whole thing. Why did they give it to a Ukrainian company?
Are you sure they did that? Are you sure they gave it to Ukraine?
Well, that's what the word is.
That was President Donald Trump with some visibly uncomfortable anchors on Fox and Friends Friday morning, the day after impeachment hearings testimony by former National Security Council Deputy Fiona Hill that, among other things, warned Republican politicians not to spread what she termed as baseless Moscow-generated conspiracy theories about Ukraine attempting to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. So much for that. Hello, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving week. And welcome to the Reasoned Roundtable podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined, as is the custom in our country, by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hi.
Howdy.
Hey Matt.
Happy Thanksgiving Monday.
That's right.
It's not a thing.
It is.
Yeah. It's Thanksgiving
it's the Monday.
Yeah.
Before Cyber Monday.
Right.
Wow.
It's pre
the true holiday.
Pre-cyber.
The real holiday.
Monday.
Peter, I would up the voltage on the shock treatment.
He's got a good point out of the gate. Before we get started here, this is a special message to you, the listening audience. Please send us your questions about the proper dose of Suderman's voltage, the proper mixing of my metaphors, whatever. Ask us literally anything using the email address podcasts, it's plural, at reason.com, because we're going to be taping a bonus episode after Thanksgiving during our annual Reason Webathon, and we want you to stump us, challenge us individually as a group. You will drive the train of this podcast, including straight into the ditch, if you want to. You have 1 week to send us those questions. So again, ask us anything. Podcasts at reason.com. You'll be glad you did. Okay, so let's set this up. Last week, the House impeachment inquiry wrapped up its first round of work by interviewing a succession of diplomats and bureaucrats who had a variety of different vantage points on what former National Security Advisor John Bolton colorfully described as a drug deal, namely the attempts by President Trump, his personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani, Mick Mulvaney, Mike Pompeo, Rick Perra, et al., to condition both a White House meeting with new Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and also nearly $500 million in the release of already authorized security assistance to Ukraine, conditioning all of this on Zelensky stating publicly that his country was launching an investigation into the family of 2020 Democratic frontrunner Joe Biden. The two most impactful, if I can use that word, which I can't.
Nope.
No, you can. It's impactful. It's fine. Just don't say impact as a verb, right, Catherine?
Unless we're talking about like meteors, I'm against all of it.
Asteroids.
Why are you guys trying to hold the line on the natural evolution of language from a bottom-up process of mongrelization?
Exactly, Nick Gillespie.
This
Thank
is
you.
The Hayekian answer, whether we're talking Friedrich or Salma. It's all about just changing the lingo. You know, as long as your
some
point's being made.
Some mutations are dead ends, Nick.
Yeah, but
99%. Look, anybody reading Marvel Comics knows that, 99.9% of mutations are dead ends. They kill people. But, then you get, the Fantastic Four. So
are you really making
the
claim that the word impactful is a superhero?
Yeah. Also, the Fantastic Four aren't mutants.
They've been mutated.
They are
broadly under Stan Lee's broad definition of children of the atom, as he talks about in the origin of Marvel Comics, as well as the son of the origins
wow.
of Marvel Comics.
We really don't want to talk about the impeachment, do
this
we, guys?
This is total evidence. Catherine, I'm just going to throw it out to you and cut off all previous thoughts. What have we learned since last we convened this August gathering of comics nerds? What have we learned? And what, if anything, or how, if any way, has your approach or thoughts about impeachment changed with this new knowledge? Catherine Mingott Wharton.
I have to say I've gone meta on the whole thing, so I'm going to apologize right now for not having useful insights about, you know, Fiona Hill's testimony, other than that the whole internet seemed to enjoy her sass. But my meta thought is, as Liz Nolan Brown summarized this morning in the Reason Roundup, there seems to have been this process of post hoc rationalization of the quid pro quo. Did you like my double Latin? Did you like that? And
I'm having
some deep thoughts about rationalization in general and how huge of a role it plays in our politics. I mean, Donald Trump does what he wants to do on the spur of the moment. He is not alone in that. Many, many politicians, and in fact, just humans in general, behave that way. And then if he gets in trouble, he kind of builds the case after the fact for why he did the thing. And this is a normal thing. People do it all the time. But when you have an entire impeachment inquiry where everyone is staring directly at those moments when you didn't have the rationalization in place to see if there was any evidence for that rationalization, it's not going to work. And that clip that you played, that we played at the beginning of the show, points out, like, when even the Fox and Friends hosts are like, I don't think that's quite right, actually. Like, that's their equivalent of losing their minds.
The
right?
Fox and Friends hosts, who literally understand themselves as the Trump whisperers, the people whose job is to play directly to the president, to please him. In fact, where Fox and Friends is a show where, for people outside the Beltway who sort of don't kind of think about this thing, it is not an exaggeration to say that people who work inside the White House, I mean the White House part of the White House, not one of those, the set of executive buildings that's next to it, inside the White House, one of the 30 or something rooms where the president and his staff works, they will tell you that the best way to communicate with Donald Trump and get his attention is not to go into his office and try to talk to him, but
it's
to go on Fox and Friends.
It's amazing. And this is the fact that these guys also know that the president's favor can be fleeting, that that to cross him once is legitimately to risk losing that favor, that they would even have attempted to push back on the Ukrainian CrowdStrike theory shows how very, very far afield it is. And yet the president plows ahead. So I'm thinking deep thoughts about how people try to justify their decisions after the fact, and that it is a plausible story. It is a plausible story to say, hey, maybe the Ukraine was up to some stuff that was genuinely bad for U.S. national security and the president wanted someone to look into it. It's just not a true story, as far as I can tell, from all the rest of the other impeachment inquiry information.
The CrowdStrike stuff certainly is not. That's been debunked by a wide variety of sources. But this is where, especially if you're going meta, the discussion over impeachment is, I find it infuriating and kind of so awful because it becomes hyper-politicized. The CrowdStrike story is false. Did Ukraine try to influence the 2016 election? Everybody said so in early 2017 without even raising it to the level of moral panic, because we hadn't yet agreed that, you know, this was the be all and end all of terrible things in America. So like I'm looking at a Politico story from January of 2017. There are CBS News stories from later in the year. You can Google and find all of this stuff everywhere where a variety of Ukrainian interests were trying to make sure that Donald Trump did not become president, because for the same reason that Putin didn't want Hillary Clinton to become president, Ukraine did not want Donald Trump to become president. And that's worth investigating. And this is one of the great things about being libertarian, about being outside the Beltway, about not being beholden to, you know, either the Republican or the Democratic Party or the liberal or conservative narratives, is that we don't have to follow their leads. We should be looking at all of this stuff broadly. Trump is wrong. And he is, you know, willfully wrong and willfully stupid. One thinks, one assumes, right? We're giving him the benefit of the doubt when he pursues debunked conspiracy theories. The larger conversation about foreign interference in American elections, you know, it's not wrong to say Ukraine was trying to make sure that Donald Trump did not become elected, just like Russia was trying not to make sure that Hillary Clinton was not elected. What the impact of all that was and what do we do next is something different. The impeachment, something else, different again.
Just to a little footnote there, though, is that what Republicans are saying isn't that Ukraine tried to influence the election. They are suggesting that Ukraine was responsible for hacking the DNC and the Clinton campaign.
Some elements are, not all. Yeah, and that's wrong, right? Or at least
there's another
the American
too,
intelligence agencies, which of course have next to no credibility because they have been the biggest fomenters of lies and misdirection and misinformation since their founding, you know, in the immediate post-war era. They say that it was, you know, that Russia was, the Russian government was behind the WikiLeaks hacking and dissemination of emails from the DNC. So let's go with that. Not all Republicans. And again, I don't care what the Republicans are saying. I care about the way that this discussion gets framed in such a way that suddenly now we are supposed to believe John Bolton, who, you know, 6 months ago, a year ago, we all knew was an architect of among the worst elements of American foreign policy. Now he becomes a knight in shining armor. We need to maintain a little bit more distance and a little bit more perspective on the way these things keep shifting in order to pass or to push very particular partisan agendas that none of us actually agree with.
But
I think it's an important distinction to make here, and I think it's there's a meta distinction that can be made as we assess the impeachment proceedings itself, which is there is people who were architects of really bad policies that led to much, much more grievous outcomes than anything under discussion here, right? The Iraq War, a little bit more momentous than some penny ante, let's try to squeeze the Ukrainian to get dirt on Biden. I mean, it's a completely different scale. However, there is something different between personal corruption and abuse of power and really bad policy. And I think it's useful to carry both of those thoughts in your mind and figure out what is the impeachment process for? Is it to correct bad policy that actually is more important? Or is it to forestall the type of corrupt, penny ante, personal abuse of power? And I think Jacob Solomon's piece on Friday was very good in kind of like trying to sort through that and think through that without even coming up with conclusions. Catherine, I interrupted you. Go on.
No, that was basically what I was going to say, actually, just that there's a distinction there. Also, even if there are good reasons on multiple levels to worry about and to even compare records on election interference by many countries, it's still not at all clear to anyone anywhere in this mix that that is what Donald Trump had in mind during the famous interactions, and that it looks from all evidence that I've seen that there was just this personal stake, which is, as you say, Matt, a different thing.
Yeah, I mean, Rudy Giuliani, again, was saying very, very explicitly on the record in May that he was going to Ukraine to dig up dirt on the Bidens that he thought would be personally beneficial to his client.
Peter, I don't think that you have weighed in on what you learned last week.
Well, I stayed off the internet for the last 3 or 4 days, so I learned that it was wonderful to not be thinking about impeachment for several days at a time.
There's a lesson there, I would suggest. Go on.
There's two things that jumped out at me. One is the willingness of Republicans not only to sort of try to turn the tables on Democrats and focus entirely on the process, which is what I've talked about before, but to embrace just completely debunked notions about Ukraine that no serious person should believe or be talking about. Again, the kinds of things where Fox News anchors are saying there's no reason to believe this. There's no evidence at all. And you have Republican lawmakers saying, well, you can believe whatever you want to believe. And if that's the case, then there's just sort of no way that we can access any truth at all, right? We have to at some point sort of have some method for figuring out what it is that we think happens or happened in the world, and it happened and in the case of the 2016 election and foreign policy. The flip side of this, though, is that there is a small but real way in which Trump is kind of right about his enemies and his opponents, in which the deep state that Trump talks about, okay, not exactly the one that Trump talks about, not this sort of conspiratorial, you know, kind of a 70s thriller type situation. That's not what the deep state is. But the deep state is a professional community that views Trump as an unfit leader as somebody who is in no way sort of doesn't believe in their kind of professional. It's correct that he's sort of he's unfit, I think, in many ways. It's correct that he doesn't sort of have their professional capacities, but also has a kind of unified mindset about what American foreign policy should be. There is, if you listen to the hearings, if you followed the impeachment hearings at all for the first week and a half, and I'm cribbing a little bit from a Ross Douthat column here, which I thought was really good, there was almost no dissent from the idea that, of course, America should be spending hundreds of millions of dollars to prop up Ukraine, that this is our role in the world, that this is part of, you know, a vital national security interest. And there is this just absolute kind of lockstep consensus that, yes, that is right. And, you know, Nick has sometimes made the point on this podcast that Trump is deconstructing the administrative state. I'm not sure that Trump is doing so in a way that is likely to be productive in the long run. But there is some real truth to the fact that a deep state of a sort exists and has a consensus mindset about American foreign policy that is, I think, not one that most of us on this podcast share, and certainly not one that a lot of Americans share, and certainly, and even more than that, not one that has really brooks any room for dissent and outside views. And that's something that I think sort of has come up out of all of this, is that, you know, it's kind of the point that I've made many times before, is that in Washington, there's just no real room for foreign policy thinking that isn't essentially interventionist and that doesn't view America as having an interventionist role in the world.
Which I think helps explain, you know, the immense bipartisan or transpartisan backlash against Trump. One of the things that I think came through, you know, the two big heroes of last week's testimony in many ways were, you know, Fiona Hill and the former ambassador to Ukraine. And in a lot of ways, when you drain their complaints of many things, what stands is the idea that they were not being taken seriously, you know, in the irregularities of foreign policy and diplomacy, et cetera. There are good grounds to maintain, you know, standard, traditional, conventional channels. Trump is clearly not doing that. And these people are pissed. And what Peter is talking about, that kind of broad-based emanations, the ripples that go through, a governmental structure and set of structures when they're told, like, yeah, I don't really give a fuck what you think, you know, that's going to cause a lot of problems. And it's not always going to be good. It's not like destroying something is always to the good. By the same token, our foreign policy, and this is something that I think is worth keeping in mind, just limiting it to the 21st century, our foreign policy on every level has been an absolute disaster. Trump is doing something different. I don't know if he is the a logical conclusion of failed foreign policy or his acts of destruction or just saying screw it will lead to something better, but it's definitely scaring the bejesus out of the status quo. And that probably is not a bad thing.
It's also, I mean, certainly a piece of evidence in favor of this thesis is that the most ardent and identifiable subset of Republican never Trumpers are the neocons, the former neocons.
The hawks.
Right? The people who in general had worked quite hard to build up sway inside this establishment, this sort of interventionist establishment, had sort of dragged the Overton window there in their direction. And so perhaps you could argue dislike Trump because he has obviated a lot of that work.
And Trump's refusal, his lack of willingness to play along with that crowd was, I think, a big key to his political success. If you remember, it was a big deal when he said the Iraq war was a bad idea on a Republican debate stage. People were like, what? He went and said that in South Carolina, which has a big military presence and is sort of fairly strongly pro-military, at least amongst the Republican side, you know, there. And people were like, well, no Republican could possibly get away with that. And what Trump showed was that, in fact, that even though there was a consensus
that in fact
amongst,
Republicans
yes,
can get
you,
away
that,
with that.
Yes, is that even though there was a completely uniform consensus amongst Republican lawmakers and Republican, appointed officials, that consensus did not exist amongst Republican voters.
I also think, though, that same crew, having, grown up in D.C. among them, do sincerely.
You worked at
the Weekly Standard. I don't know if you know that about me.
Neocon HQ,
yeah,
right?
Yep. And the other thing about that crew is that they very, very sincerely believe and spent a lot of time thinking and talking about character and virtue and the idea of a good civic leader and what that looks like. And so it's a little hard for me to disentangle.
And that's not
which
Trump,
is a
right?
joke.
Yes,
right,
it's a
though?
Little hard
I mean,
for me to. No, I mean, it in the same way that it's a little hard for me to, to disentangle how much of the animus against Trump in that crew is this sort of self-interested isn't the right term, but this sort of narrowly interested, goal of continuing a quite interventionist foreign policy, and how much of it is he is not the right, he is not our philosopher king. He is not the right man to lead our republic, because God knows, I fact-checked an awful lot of articles about that topic. And I think it's, it would be a mistake to discount that as a very sincere motivation on the part of a lot of intellectual conservatives.
Oh, I agree.
The trouble is that the place that it's taking them right now in the age of Trump is into some weird kind of nationalist waters as one of the reactionary options.
I think what Trump is showing is that, that's a sincere motivation on their part, and it's completely irrelevant to how the government functions and whether the government does good or bad or whatever. I mean, I think what we're seeing, and there's one way of reading the 2016 election, is that it was ultimately a referendum on American interventionism, because Hillary Clinton was the absolute spokesperson for, the America everywhere position. She went through, Matt, you talked about this, every opportunity you got, and I think it was the right thing to do. She was still talking about Libya as a success. She was the neocon's neocon. She was the person who believed that America is the indispensable nation, and it should be everywhere all the time, preferably dropping bombs or threatening to drop bombs. And it's a complete failure and a complete wreck. People are pissed. But I think that's one of the reasons why Trump won. He did evince some empathy for people who had been left behind, whether he's done anything for them or not. But part of that is, and this goes back to the Vietnam era, people in small towns who were coughing up their sons to go die in Vietnam, were kind of like, maybe by the end of the war, they were like, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. Trump was totally channeling into that. And, and it makes it really complicated for all of us. He's such a despicable character. He was a draft dodger. He was this, he was that. But, he's generally right on foreign policy. And he's more important, he's generally in tune with where America is.
I'm not going to.
Though I do want to say, you just said whether he's done anything for them or not. And I think that is a way too soft characterization. He has not done anything good for those people that he correctly identified as being victims or left behind, either
no,
of the trade.
That's not true.
Trade,
I mean, the economy is better.
Or,
yeah. No, trade
or of our foreign policy.
Trade unemployment is down, and his trade policies are stupid, but the economy is better now than it was when he took office. People are doing better now than when he took office. I mean, if you just.
But you and I know better than anyone that crediting a good economy to a president is
a
mistake.
If it was shitty, wouldn't he be taking the blame? I agree. I agree with all of that. But that's what I'm
saying too.
You can't say he didn't do anything because he did subsidize the farmers who took a beating,
Peter,
in his trade war.
Why would you say that to me? Why would you look at me and say those words? All right, sorry, Matt.
Look, the economy, if the president can't do anything good, or like you can't, if he can't take credit for a good economy, he can't take blame for a bad economy. Ergo, his trade policy is irrelevant.
That's not a smart way of looking 100%. At things. I mean, just
no, but it is
has,
like
he
so.
He has a mix of
it's
good
just,
policies and bad policies, and the economy
which
kind
is
of does,
different.
Kind of does what it does, and pointing at a scoreboard one way or the other and having a black-white kind of thing, that's not smart discussion. The trade war is bad and stupid. The anti-regulation stuff has largely, except when it's gone into a pro-regulatory direction, which it also has, but a lot of the deregulation stuff has been good. One could say that the cutting down tax rates was good, although the process to get there is bad.
The standard protocol for, and this is Reagan, you know, are you better off now than you were 4 years
ago?
Yeah,
but you know,
and I'm not saying, why do we shift?
You're saying that we shouldn't have these dumb arguments, and you're having a dumb argument.
It's not a dumb argument. It's in the aggregate.
To say to point at the scoreboard is, you know, we could say that Barack Obama's second term was phenomenal because it was pointing all in the same direction as Trump's. And I wouldn't say that. That's one of the reasons he got reelected.
That things were better than when he took office.
Right.
He did a lot of bad policies. But all I'm saying is, you know, that's how Americans vote. Right.
That's interesting, and it's always worth keeping in mind. But if we are assessing whether or not the president has done fill in the blank for voters, according to our own lights of policy analysis, it's going to take more than pointing at a scoreboard. I mean, the scoreboard tells us a lot about elections. But I wanted to say a couple of ombudsman-style points here. Catherine, I believe, or Peter or somebody, Catherine was saying that Never Trumps are basically a bunch of hawks. That's true. There's a lot, you know, maybe the largest faction of Never Trumpers, if we're describing.
It wasn't an exclusive characterization. There is an identifiable clump in that pudding.
I just want to point out that another clump, a smaller rice pudding style clump in that pudding, thank you, is the libertarian wing. I mean, Justin Amash is not an interventionist. Yep. Andrew Napolitano is not an interventionist, yet they have been early and often sounding the alarm bells on the president's actions in office. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. Another one, Peter, you're talking about the forever hawks of the deep state. And I think there's a lot definitely to that. I would be hesitant to point specifically at the people who were carrying out Ukraine policy and lasering in on that, because as actually the Republicans pointed out correctly, whether or not we agree with it, but as they pointed out correctly during the hearings, Trump has done more about sending more Javelin missiles to Ukraine than Barack Obama ever did. Barack Obama was hesitant about that. And some of the testimony during this was exploring that hesitance and reticence. And it looks like those deep state people who right now are testifying against Donald Trump, they actually prefer Trump's policy on X. So I would be hesitant to ascribe their motivations in the particular about this, because Trump's policy as it has been carried out doesn't cut in that clean way. And finally, I would just say that, yes, it's always and forever our job as the Flava Flaves of politics to jump in and point out that not only that 9/11 is a joke, but to point out that
That it should be privatized.
It should be absolutely privatized. No, that there is an awful foreign policy and plenty of other things. Consensus that a lot of the manners police out there have been wrong about. And they should never not be reminded of that. However, can people who are wrong on policy also be right about a thing? And the answer is yes. And you have to be able to hold in your minds, in my estimation, all of those things. Let's move to Democrats. The other big political news, sometimes happening on the same day, after a long day of hearing, there was a Democratic debate. I only got two drinks in at the Distilled Spirits Council party because I had to go home and watch the debate. Anyways, it was the fifth Democratic debate so far. I think we're going to have 12 at least in the season, although there have been plenty of other multi-candidate bore fests. Takeaways include, and Reason had a bunch of great pieces on this, but you had Cory Booker kind of speedbagging Joe Biden on pot and race. Tulsi Gabbard and Pete Buttigieg is like round two or three of their endless and very entertaining spats on foreign policy. Elizabeth Warren struggling to defend her latest Medicare positioning. And all of this is against the backdrop of the big news this week, which is America's mayor, Michael Bloomberg, is dumping $30+ million in an ad blitz to somehow win Super Tuesday. Nick, I want to start with you. You previewed the whole thing by saying, wanted, a Dem presidential candidate who defends individualism, capitalism, and non-interventionism. Did you find one?
Oh, yeah. They're everywhere. But, you know, once to look at them, they disappear. It's a very complicated hunt. It's like a snipe hunt, Matt. No, but you can, you know, again, what I find most fascinating at this point about the Democratic debates, you know, which are, you know, Catherine, I can say now, and I'll speak for Matt and Peter and myself, given that these things happen on a monthly basis, we, you know, now men can understand the dread with which women face their periods.
Wow. You're not wrong, honestly. Yeah. It's really the same. I get really grumpy for a couple days before them. And then, you're right.
But
didn't you write in Politico that you love debates?
Yeah, I do. I like debates, like debating, not these
debates.
Let's move
Matt,
on.
The thing that I take a good deal of comfort in, and I think that we all should, is the broad range of agreement that almost all of the Democratic candidates believe in, and also Donald Trump. And these have to do with things like pot legalization. Joe Biden is the great outlier, as well Michael Bloomberg will be when he starts yapping full time. But, you know, Donald Trump, along with all of the other Democratic candidates, essentially believe that marijuana should be legalized, or at the very least should not. The policy on marijuana should not be dictated by the federal government. You know, the Free Banking Act is moving through Congress. All indications are, I've talked to a couple of lobbyists, they say, you know, there's no question Mitch McConnell will sign it, and that Trump has already pledged to sign a bill that would allow industries in states, businesses in states that have legalized pot, to use the banking system and things like that. This is immense. Criminal justice reform, a variety of other types of topics that people have taken for granted. Like, you know, that libertarians have been beating the drums on things like marriage equality. I mean, it's amazing to think, you know, how recently something like marriage equality went from being something that the Democratic Party did not even embrace, Barack Obama didn't, to nobody even gives a shit about it anymore. There is a consensus. It's not a perfect one, but it is in Donald Trump, who is imperfect in following through on this. And most of the Democrats say, you know, that America should not be the world's policeman. What a difference, you know, a couple of years makes and things like that. And, you know, it's easy to say that libertarian ideas have faded, you know, either as a flavor of the month or don't have purchase in American politics. But there's a lot of stuff in the background that is actually, you know, it's concretizing and putting forward basically libertarian positions. So that's what I took out of this debate as much as anything, was that the individuals are terrible, but the platform they're standing on already includes a ton of stuff we don't have to fight about anymore.
Catherine, I was not expecting Nick to go positive there. So I'm just trying to get my equilibrium back. But asking someone who's been a Mayor Pete stan or a Chasten stan, did Cory Booker win back your heart a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've had a sort of Cory Booker stand-dom also. And I will say I enjoyed and also was appalled by the fact that it felt refreshing to have someone on the stage of the Democratic debate say, you know, actually growth and entrepreneurship are good. Like, that shouldn't have been like a, wow, hey, remember that? So as much as I always enjoy the Nick Gillespie song about how the libertarian moment is actually all around us and it's the friends we made along the way, like, it is a noticeable loss from the Democratic stage, from past iterations. Like, they used to pay more lip service to this thing where, like, small business people were still heroes and economic growth, broadly speaking, was still good. And the fact that it came as such a surprise, as such a sort of unexpected shock when Cory Booker was like, actually, maybe we do want the economy to grow, especially for people who aren't already stakeholders, who haven't already won the status quo, who are supposed to be the people that the Democratic Party is sticking up for and that I, Cory Booker, am sticking up for. So I was both heartened by that theme in his remarks and also saddened that it felt fresh.
I like how
wait till Bloomberg will pour some gas on that fire too.
I like how Booker, having had his category safely evacuated, with the loss of Beto O'Rourke and Kristen Gillibrand, and Julian Castro wasn't even on stage. So people who had been formerly trying to hide anything that was centristy about them, suddenly Corey's like, oh, now I'm going to write the op-ed for the New York Times about how charter schools are awesome. Like, yeah. We cleared those bastards out.
Like, better late than never, I guess. Also, of course, I think we all enjoyed the Cory Booker's facial expressions in response to Joe Biden's Blafrican Americans love me comment, which was just an incredible moment. He literally said Blafrican Americans.
I didn't even catch that. I was too busy focusing in.
There was so much going on.
Nobody is
forgotten the existence of Kamala Harris.
Which, when he used Hayekian principles to invent that word, would you say it was impactful?
Yeah, Nick, I
love it.
Word,
you know what? Joe Biden, the Blafricans love him. He's still, much more popular among Black Americans than Cory Booker. And I just want to puncture the Cory Booker bubble on reason. It's like he's an awful politician for the most part. He's got a couple of good things. You know, he's done criminal justice reform. He's done certain types of privacy things and surveillance things with Rand Paul and others, which is all good. His signature issue, which he didn't deliver on in Newark, when he took a ton of money from Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, what an evil genius that guy was, didn't really deliver on school reform in Newark. But the good thing about him was that he was Mr. School Choice and Mr. Opportunity, and he's been hiding that candle under a bushel barrel for a long time. It's nice to see him come out. He epitomizes to me why Democrats are totally uninspiring. There's nothing going on there other than he's trying to be as blank as possible so we can project as much of our hopes and dreams on him. And then every time he opens his mouth.
Worked great for Obama, man.
Not so good for the country, though, right? Because we thought Obama was the peace candidate, and he wasn't at all. You know, we thought Obama was going to bring politics of hope and change. And now the New York Times is running op-ed saying, oh, Obama was a conservative and a consensus builder. He was the exact opposite. I mean, like, open your eyes. These guys all suck.
Suderman, just to keep with Nick's original optimism, which already has evaporated
really
in a pool
went,
of
no,
blood.
Really
optimism,
that
all
under
of
the
this
bushel
stuff,
barrel.
Every advance happens in spite of, you know, specific politicians.
Should we take it as
it builds a new baseline.
Should we take it as an optimistic sign, Peter Suderman, as someone who wrote a post called the Anybody But Warren Primary? Should we take it as at least a flicker of something in the darkness that Elizabeth Warren seems to have topped out and is retreating now and suffering now, kind of as what seems to be a direct result of her trying to explain how she's going to pay for Medicare for all. And suddenly people are like, I don't know, dude, that doesn't add up. Is there something optimistic in that?
A positive sign in the sense that when you total your car and find out that, wait, the groceries that you had in the back actually are still viable. Like, yeah, I get it. You still that, totaled your car.
Do you need to tell us a story, Peter? That sounded real specific.
It's more positive than not that. On the other hand, it's not like, oh man, this is great. I would say it is not so much heartening, but revealing that Elizabeth Warren peaked and has now started to fade a little bit in the polls. And as that has happened, she has become the target of a lot of the other candidates, in particular Pete Buttigieg and Cory Booker, just piled on her at the beginning of the debate. And, you know, not in a you're not bringing people together kind of way. Like, there was a little bit of that. There was a little bit of like, oh, you're not a consensus, a unifying candidate. But there were specific policy criticisms that I thought were actually pretty important. Cory Booker said, hey, you know what? That wealth tax, it isn't going to work because other countries have tried it and it doesn't raise the revenue you think it's going to raise. Pete Buttigieg was like, this Medicare for All plan that you have is too expensive and takes away choice from people. I don't think that Pete Buttigieg's healthcare plan is all that great, but it's nice to hear somebody say, actually, Elizabeth Warren's plan, which is much more radical even than what Pete Buttigieg would do, which would still be a big expansion of government and I would still oppose. But it was nice to hear somebody say, actually, your plans that you have built your campaign around are built on bad assumptions, bad faith, and bad ideas.
The highlight of the debate, I think I mentioned this within some kind of intra-reason thing or maybe on Twitter or whatever, but after the debate, Amy Klobuchar, who is obviously going to be the next president of these United States, which will incorporate Ukraine as the 58th state if Obama's state count is proper, she said she was pissed at her colleagues. And she was like, they keep saying, this was on Hardball, they keep promising free stuff. Like, we can't afford that. It's not going to work. That was a welcome, kind of dose of cold water in the face after a festival of free shit, of free giveaways. So
if anyone understands cold water, it's Amy Klobuchar.
Oh, it's Klobuchar. Yeah. She lives on cold water and salad.
And throwing forks. I want to.
No, she didn't throw the fork. She ate her salad with a comb.
Right. But what did she throw? Did she throw a cell phone or was it like a mirror? What she did throw something at somebody.
Maybe it was just an icy Fiona Hill like glare.
Ooh.
Right? Stopped you
dead. By the way, wouldn't it have been much better if it had been either Faith Hill or Fiona Apple testifying in Congress this week?
I probably made that mistake more than the Joaquin Castro mistake that I make every day.
I was, for some reason, kept thinking of Fiona from Shrek, to be honest.
Would it have been daytime or nighttime, Fiona? Either way. Or that would be great to, like, the hearings run late, and she's like, am I going to testify before sundown? That could be quite dramatic.
She threw a binder, by the way.
Amy Klobuchar threw that involves Fiona Apple is a better afternoon than afternoons that don't.
That's true.
That, again, sounded a little bit too specific to be comfortable for anybody. I wanted to, because it touches on themes that we have hit here before on this Roundtablist podcast many times previously. I wanted to make sure that we had time to explore what Nick described as the evil Facebooks and such. At the end, last Thursday, I don't know about y'all, but my Twitter feed absolutely exploded with praise for Sacha Baron Cohen, comedian of Borat fame, gave a speech at the Anti-Defamation League about what he called the Silicon Six of Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Google, Apple, and Amazon, calling them collectively, quote, the greatest propaganda machine in history. propagators of, quote, ideological imperialism, a grave threat to democracy, and all of this. Catherine, can you begin to count the ways in which the sainted Mr. Baron Cohen might be wrong?
I mean, you gotta, I guess, admire him reading the crowd. I mean, the ADL has called repeatedly for social media to censor hate speech and particularly anti-Semitic speech. So he decided this was a good place to launch his thesis on this topic. In a lot of the articles about this, there was just this sort of throwaway line that said, the ADL has called on big tech before, da da da. And then it would say, in October, Facebook CEO pledged $2.5 million to the organization. Like, can you imagine giving the ADL $2.5 million and then a month later having this speech make the news?
Like, they must have asked for $5
million. Yeah, 25.
I know. I mean, the rage. Obviously, Sacha Baron Cohen is not only wrong, but dangerously wrong about his thesis. I always find it amazing when people are, when people make these comparisons to the worst moments, the worst actions of governments, and they compare it to a thing that Peter Suderman literally has signed off of and will never go on again and was free to do that and has continued on in his life.
Highly recommended.
With no trouble at all. That continues to me to be such a crucial service. You cannot engage with any of these products. You can just stop using them and live your life. And that is not...
No, you can't. They're hopelessly addictive. I'm on it right now.
Imperialism is the opposite of that. That is such a mismatch. It is such a false comparison. And I've never convinced anyone by making that point. And so I'm not convincing anyone now, but it remains true.
I will say the worst part of not being on Facebook is that occasionally my friends and colleagues have to text me to let me know which bar they're at.
Horrible.
It's really, it's a huge, and every now and then I don't see that somebody has gone to a particular bar. Since we're talking about Sacha Baron Cohen, I just want to read a brief quote from him from 2016 talking about filming a difficult scene in the movie Borat. These are his words. "The worst part filming Borat was the naked fight, because I had a 250-pound man's ass on my face, and his buttocks was so big that I couldn't actually breathe when I was underneath there. So I had about 30 seconds of air under there before I had to breathe in, and I had a signal with the director, which was when I thought I was going to pass out, I would hit the mattress three times. I'm very glad that this man is concerned for our democracy."
By the way, the director of Borat was Larry Charles, who was a big wheel in the Seinfeld, in the development of Seinfeld. He's a very funny guy. Is currently can be found on Twitter ranting about how the 2016 election was a coup and it was a stolen election, blah, 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 and that we live in a autocracy or something like that. I think the best way to understand Sacha Baron Cohen, who's very funny, and the Ali G show was kind of the culmination of the 90s move towards spoofing as well as revealing people and just kind of, you know, I mean, just the culmination of a lot of trends that revealed how gullible people were, et cetera. These people are the insane end of a kind of Hollywood elite liberalism where they are so out of touch either, you know, with the way that common people process information and live their lives. They are useless when they comment on it, or they are such, you know, precious overbred Siamese cats who are so willing to buy every fucking dumb idea that comes into their brain. They, again, are equally useless in telling us how to live or to do anything other than entertaining us in spare moments after we do a hard day's work and get on with living our lives. It's really a shame. Sacha Baron Cohen, if I'm not mistaken, is also like an Oxbridge graduate and whatnot, really goes to show that, you know, British elites, and we see this in the royal family every day, have been bred to the point of total stupidity and regression well below the mean. This is just a fundamentally dumb argument that robs everybody of agency. And I would argue, I read that in rapid succession with another New York Times story that pointed out kind of casually that one of the reasons Trump won was because Facebook, good company that they were, they go to all of their major advertisers and they say, hey, we'll give you a person who will help you optimize your advertising for what you're trying to do. The Trump campaign, even though Trump doesn't use email, you know, he's writing in a gold Sharpie on his own face, you know, to send messages. His campaign guy, you know, Brad Parscale, who's a really, you know, smart, forward-looking guy, basically learned a lot from the Obama campaigns in 2008 and 2012, said, yeah, here's what we're trying to do. They maximized their outcome, squeaked in a victory. Hidden in that article, which was all about how Facebook helped Trump win, was a paragraph or two about the Hillary Clinton campaign where they stiff-armed Facebook and they said, we don't want you around here because they were afraid that Facebook was going to sell them more advertising.
If you want to have a really good job, it's selling Democratic campaigns for president in 2020, yep, all of the Facebook ads and targeting services. Holy crap.
Yeah, no, but it's like, you know, what all of I fully and firmly believe that 90% of the conversations we're having now are simply because Hillary Clinton lost an election that nobody, including Trump and Hillary, thought that she could possibly lose. And now we are trying to come up with all of these cockamamie theories to explain away the fact that she ran absolutely the shittiest, dumbest, most solipsistic, narcissistic, incompetent campaign of all time. And now it's like, well, Facebook is evil. Russia is running everything in America. You know, they're the reason why the Astros are suddenly a top tier baseball team and things like that. It all goes back to the fact that Hillary Clinton totally screwed up. And like, that's now it's social media is a threat because it elected Donald Trump. No, none of this elected Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton elected Donald Trump. And now all of us, especially those of us who never voted for Hillary Clinton, are paying for it.
Speaking of the Hollywood elites and the buttockses on people's faces during filming seasons, let's shift to our what are you consuming at the end of podcast thing that we do here where we talk about what we've consumed, because I want to start with me finally realizing what has been clearly to the listeners and at least two of the other three of you probably all three, is that I have basically, when it comes to popular culture, become Terry Teachout, minus the minus the actual talent.
I haven't seen you in a while, but are you now wearing plus size clothes, Matt?
Welch? My field of expertise is as locked into my own distant decades as his are, and Terry Teachout's phenomenal. He's a great follow. Go check him out, and a great writer. But I was watching the American...
Those Deanna Durbin musicals from the 1930s are chef's kiss.
I had that breakthrough realization finally last night watching the American Music Awards, which I always like to watch music award shows just to kind of like see what the kids are doing. And realize at this point, I don't even know who the hosts are anymore. Like, is this woman came out, her name was like Sienna, or like Sierra. She had one name, no idea, zero. Like, couldn't pick her out of a police lineup. That was great. I didn't recognize or know.
But there were like no vowels in however it was spelled. It was like CXR or something.
I presume so. I didn't look too closely. Didn't have closed captions on. I think I knew... with the exception of the ye old performers that they would wheel out, like Shania Twain, who was great, but like of the contemporary performers, I think I recognized three of them, and one of them was Taylor Swift. So like it wasn't a big haul.
That's negative points.
And one of them was Lizzo, who I think Catherine introduced me to like a week and a half ago.
You're welcome.
And then like one of them is this guy named Post Malone. The
Matt, Post Malone is washed up. What are you talking
Matt,
about,
can you,
Matt?
I think he can stop.
He was in the Traveling Wilburys, for Christ's sake.
Oh, it's the end of the line, as they famously sang. For me, I was watching it and thinking to myself, I don't understand even a tiny, tiny, not even one molecule of me understands how he could ever even sell one record. And I just realized that that's it. I am old, and it is great. It is glorious, and I'm going to embrace it. And in fact, I have been listening not just to the Traveling Wilburys, but to Volume 3, Nick. Volume 3. Okay,
the
Catherine.
Traveling Wilburys, great, great stuff. All the way through.
They understood that the best use of Bob Dylan is as comedy relief on a bridge, and it's totally true. Catherine, you go.
So what I'm consuming this week, it owes a debt to one of the great producers of this podcast, Ian Kaiser, who turned me onto the YouTube channel Girlfriend Reviews. And the way that this YouTube channel works is that a gal reviews video games from the perspective of what it is like when her boyfriend plays them.
Oh.
And this is exactly how I want to consume video games. Like, my sum total knowledge of all video games in the world are the things that you listeners have also heard Peter Suderman say on this podcast and this YouTube channel, and it is enough. It is exactly right. And I have actually I've been meaning to share this recommendation with the group for a while, but I kept forgetting because sometimes you have to recommend a book about grammar. And it's good that I waited because last week was the 1 year anniversary of this channel, and her non-review of a new game, Death Stranding, which earlier in the office I straight up referred to as Death Standing because I don't know anything about video games, but it doesn't matter, is the most beautiful thing. It's beautiful, y'all. She decides not to quite review the game, but instead to, as she says, this isn't a review of Death Stranding. It is how Death Stranding convinced me video games have potential beyond belief. And it is this beautiful, beautiful meditation on the form of the video game and how it has the ability to make you feel things that other media can't. So if you have never played a video game since like Super Mario Brothers, but maybe you kind of want to know what's up, Girlfriend Reviews, do it.
That sounds like it's made for me. I haven't played one since, I think, the second issue of Civilization. Nick, you go next.
I finished Man in the High Castle. The season ended after, I guess, four seasons. I consider it, one of the best, kind of most brilliant meditations on both history, but also our ability to change history and to look in the past or to alternatives that either existed or we hope to exist and kind of transport information and practices from elsewhere into our everyday life. And it was a very, very satisfying four season run. It's on Amazon. It's an Amazon original. If you're a fan of the Philip K. Dick novel, this the Philip K. Dick novel always read like a kind of outline for a book or an imagined world. This filled it in with like fantastic particulars to create a richly imagined fictional universe that you can live in and that you can kind of explore. And it really, you know, over time, it became a kind of metaphor for resistance, both in the show, but also to Donald Trump. I don't think you need to be slavishly devoted to that kind of anti-Trump stuff to understand that what it's about is that at any given moment in time, we are filled with a multiplicity of paths forward. And it's up to us to kind of define what we want to do and then to build a consensus and the possibilities for it. It's just rich, rich text. And particularly if you are of the age that remembers either having relatives, parents or grandparents in World War II, and the way that Nazi and Axis and Allied iconography just suffused American popular culture from sometime beginning in the mid-30s all the way through to sometime, you know, I would say that it kind of started to peter out with something like Saving Private Ryan, when the actual people who fought the war stopped being the ones producing it, and it became more of a baby boomer production. It's just a really high artistic achievement that is also philosophically rich and I think ideologically and politically powerful.
It's great. What's your name, Peter?
That is my name. I saw The Irishman, the new movie from Martin Scorsese. It's a masterpiece. It is an absolutely fantastic movie. First, about Jimmy Hoffa and about unions and about union crime and all this sort of sleazy criminality that was sort of embedded in the union movement in the 1970s. But it is also surprisingly an incredibly Catholic movie about the wages of sin. And
I hear they are death.
Yes, they are. And so
if you believe that the man from Galilee came and he paid the ultimate ransom, Catherine.
One of the things that stuck out to me here is that Martin Scorsese often makes movies in thematic pairs. And so you can think of Taxi Driver and King of Comedy as his two big statements about male alienation. You can think of Goodfellas and Casino as his big pieces on crime and the mob. And it kind of looked like The Irishman was just going to be another one of those, another mob crime movie. But in fact, it's a great pair with his movie about Catholic priests in Japan, Silence. Which was another movie. It was a movie about violence and faith and crises of faith and what it means to live a good life. And so I highly recommend the movie. And the final note I want to add on this is I saw this movie in the theater. Right now, it has been playing for the last couple of weeks only in select theaters across the United States. But this is a movie that was made for and produced by Netflix. And so everybody can see it on their Netflix subscription at home starting this Wednesday. Martin Scorsese recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times in which he defended the theatrical experience and sort of talked about how he didn't really view superhero movies as real cinema. And it was very much about how we're losing the theatrical experience and how it's important to go see movies on a very big screen together. And I really love seeing movies at the theater. I think I actually kind of agree, like it's a great communal experience. I like getting out of the house. I like seeing things there. And yet I saw this movie at a local art house theater that does a good job that I really enjoy going to. And it wasn't a great experience. The crowd wasn't great. The seating wasn't super comfortable, especially for a movie that is 3.5 hours long. And I say this in part because this weekend I spent a little bit of time cobbling together a home theater system in my basement in my house. And the experience in my basement, in my house, of watching a movie is just a lot better than the experience I had watching The Irishman in an art house theater here in Washington, D.C. And I'm really looking forward to watching it again the right way, which is at home on my couch and not what Martin Scorsese intended.
I am sparing the entire audience and especially my co-podcasters adapting some Brian Wilson lyrics from 1964 for Peter Suderman. But you just know that you deserve them. That is as much time.
I don't even know what that is.
Exactly.
What, like, is that the wages of my sin?
Are you calling him a vegetable? Are you calling him a vegetable?
Our adapted Brian Wilson lyrics?
Nick, I said 64, not 66, man.
In my room?
Yes, absolutely.
Is it?
Okay. In my room or on my couch?
Scorsese.
As a teenager, I discovered most of Martin Scorsese's great movies watching them on VHS on 13 or 25 inch old CRT televisions, pan and scan, absolutely the worst way to watch these things. I've still never seen Taxi Driver on a big screen. I've probably seen that movie 100 times, literally 100 times all the way through, 200 or 300 times in segments. And that is how you discover movies that like that become part of your life, that become like an integral part of you, especially these days, as you watch them repeatedly at home, and you just sort of my favorite novel is Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, because what happens at the end is each person becomes a book. You in the book and your favorite text become the same. You become joined and your identity is indistinguishable. And that's what happens with great movies and great works of art and these things. And it happens in a lot of cases, it happens at home when you have time to just sort of pour over things and engage and just
Peter,
sort of,
doesn't it happen more with movies like Star Wars and Marvel and DC comic movies that Martin Scorsese hates? Those are great movies to see in the theater because you're part of a fan community and it's a communal space rather than, you know, an artistic one where you're supposed to be quiet and pay homage to the person, you know, to the great thinker and director on the screen.
I absolutely love seeing movies at a theater. I love midnight showings. I love waiting in lines. There's photos of me dressed as Obi-Wan Kenobi on the front page of the Northwest Florida Daily News, the local newspaper I grew up with, my senior year in high school, waiting in line to see The Phantom Menace. I went and saw it 2 more times the next day at the movie theater. Right. Yes. Matt Welch, everything you thought
Matt,
about me.
I mean, it's like the difference between going to see a great concert or wanting to listen to something, you know, in the privacy of your own headphones.
No. I'm just saying
and yet,
he went
why
back
did
the
I
next
go
day
see The Phantom
twice,
Menace?
The fan on purpose. The Phantom Menace.
Why did I go
two
see The Phantom Menace?
It's
three
great.
Times on opening day is because I had watched Star Wars and the rest of the original trilogy about 1,000,000 times on VHS at home.
I wish they had extended the Senate sequences, the procedural votes in the Senate. You know, I'd still be watching that. Why is it the Mandalorian and whatnot? Why isn't it just, you know, Star Wars C-SPAN?
You know what I want to see?
That would be so fucking great.
Mitch McConnell learned all of his tricks.
Do you know what I want to see? One of these damn Star Wars after all this talk about the Trade Federation and the trade routes. I want to see some trade. I want to see some freighters. I want to see some ports. I want to see some
you
containers.
Know what, you want to see containerized cargo in the Star Wars universe?
At port privatization? Come
Who
on.
Who doesn't?
Yeah.
Han Solo was a smuggler, guys. He had those storage, the secret storage bins that,
true.
You know, were like the most obvious hiding place in the world.
But that's
where he hid his smuggled cargo because trade restrictions made it difficult for him
But they made it
cargo.
Possible for him to be awesome.
Yes, that's also true.
Speaking of awesome, I'm going to unplug Peter Suderman's microphone lest he spend the next 5 hours talking about this stuff. But again, thanks for listening. Send us your questions. We only have a week left to do this. We're going to do a special bonus episode.
Where do you send those questions,
Matt?
I have a lot of questions.
You send them via email, the email machine of your choice, podcasts. Plural there, podcasts@reason.com. You can ask Nick a very specific question about whether he has black leather underwear. You can ask Peter to not ever say anything more about Star Wars, especially The Phantom Menace. You can ask questions for the group, whatever. Send them to us. We will answer them as long as we can in an upcoming episode, a special bonus one during the Reason Webathon. It should be fun and should be great. Please challenge us. Thank you. And also make sure... just a reminder to go to reason.com/podcasts to subscribe to all of our offerings, including obviously the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forward debates. Thank you again and see you next week. Happy Thanksgiving.
My mother sewed me an Obi-Wan Kenobi robe.
Wow.
Because she loves you.
Yeah, that's love.